Hello, and welcome to another episode of Such Stuff, the podcast from Shakespeare's Globe. This week on the podcast, we'll be talking about disability and performance. We've recently held a number of workshops and events here at the Globe, some public and some backstage research and development, which have looked at the relationship between disability and performance on our stages. Here's our access manager, David Burwood, on the work he's doing and the sorts of questions he's been asking.
My name is David Burwood, and I'm the access manager at Shakespeare's Globe, which fundamentally means that I am responsible for assuring that the requirements and needs of deaf, disabled and neurodivergent people are met. And those people could be interacting with us in any level, so they might be patrons or volunteers or staff or performers. Of late, we've been running a series of very different workshops. Lots of them have different aims. But for me and our work here, I think what's most important is finding out what barriers exist in our structures, in our work practices, and how that has detrimentally affected people from engaging with our work or potentially stopped people from engaging with our work. We recently ran a workshop with a group of visually impaired actors and sighted actors and stand-up comedians about their relationship to certain Shakespeare texts. We've run workshops for deafblind people, for dyslexic people, and we host a lot of sharing. So we recently had work in-house around dyslexia. We recently hosted workshops on dementia and how we can better provide for people living with dementia, even though their contact with us is obviously quite transient. We live in quite a hostile society toward otherness a lot of the time. And I think that is especially true for disabled people. And there are lots of strata to that. You know, politically it's very hostile. It can be socially hostile. It can be geographically or architecturally hostile. And the Globe, interestingly, for me at least, and what really keeps me going, or at least what I find most interesting, is we're built on terms of democracy. Our stage is a clear blank stage. Our spaces are open to the elements and everyone is inside them together. And their senses feed into how the play is made. Their senses and their reactions create the play as much as anything else. So it's important for us to have as many different people inside the democracy of our spaces to create the strongest performances. It's very easy in other theatres to pretend there isn't an audience. But here, it's a lot more. It's not even interactive, it's intersensory. It's a combination of all of the lived experiences, both on stage and off stage, together working through imaginative forces to create that play. It's also important that we allow everyone to understand that Shakespeare is for them, that Shakespeare is jointly owned by everyone who decides to engage with him and his works. Because sometimes systems can let people get the wrong impression, especially educational systems. And educational systems for deaf and disabled people can tell them that Shakespeare isn't for them. It can be a very loud, clear message. So part of the Globe's work is obviously to rectify that mistake. Recently, I've been reading an essay by J.R.R. Tolkien, and he has sort of a dig at Shakespeare at being a bad fabulist. So he says, oh, the problem with Shakespeare is that he comes up with witches, but of course you put them on stage, and then the witches don't work. And I think J.R.R. Tolkien could have done to come and see a play here, because Shakespeare's fabulism and Shakespeare's storytelling aren't those literal plays. A disabled actor, a deaf actor, can take any of the roles and choose whether or not to use the lens of lived experience to manifest that role. And that's a great, it's a gift to any actor. It's a gift to say, yes, you can inject your life into what this character is going through. Or, yes, you can put on the clothes of someone entirely different and reassess things. That's an incredible gift. And that gap between literalism and imaginative work is really where any of us as humans, I think, can find space for ourselves.
So this week on the podcast, we'll catch up with some of the people we met through these workshops. We look at disability in relation to the characters and parts that we see, or often don't see, on our stages. We'll be asking how we increase representation on our stages, and the changes we need to make for that to be possible. We look at the relationship between Shakespeare and disability, and ask whether the way in which Shakespeare is written and performed might be more or less accessible than other forms of drama. And an idea proposed by the wonderful Jessie Parrott, who'll be joining us later. We talk about theatre as either a mirror to see yourself in, or a window in which to see the world through someone else's perspective. So, we chat to performers Nadia Albina, Jessie Parrott and Dougie Walker about the parts, Shakespearean or otherwise, that they've played, how disability has and hasn't informed those performances, and what it's like to perform and participate in an industry whose structures are designed for those with different experiences to them. First up, Nadia Albina. Nadia has been in a number of productions here at the Globe and is also active in the industry in working to improve access and the structures which limit certain performers. David chatted to her about the barriers in the industry, beginning with training, and the changes she's seen in the last few years. Here's Nadia.
Hello, I'm Nadia Albina and I'm an actress and I've worked at Shakespeare's Globe, very luckily, on Amelia and Macbeth and Othello.
Now, something we talk a lot about at Shakespeare's Globe is the transformative power of Shakespeare. You know, has Shakespeare ever really influenced something in your life or changed your outlook on?
Yeah, I think the way in which he writes and the stories he tells, I go back to again and again and again, only because I feel like out of all of the ways in which he puts words together, they capture the human condition more than anyone. And there are soliloquies and scenes where the writing is just so amazing that you can't really capture it in a feeling. It's just, there are no words for what he does, I think. For me, the magic at the Globe is about connection. And it is about looking at the audience, and it is about communicating a story, and that's where those two things happen the best, I think, Shakespeare's words and his language. It's just, it's an amazing place to be. And it's because it's inclusive. There's a celebration in that circle, in that O, and it kind of makes everyone feel that they're on the same page, that the hierarchy somehow isn't the same as in another theatre. And I think that makes everyone feel equal.
Yeah. I think that's really, it's such a potent thing to have as a space and as an ethos, I think, for that sort of inclusion.
It's visible. You know, you meet in the daylight. You see everybody in the daylight. Nobody's in a box or, you know, everybody's there together. And I think that really does make a difference to how you receive something, especially if you're intimidated by.
I think there are a couple of points that would be useful to eke out. One's about visibility, actually.
Yeah.
Because obviously you've worked a lot in representation.
Yeah.
Which is tied into visibility so much because of your work for Act for Change.
Yes, yeah. Act for Change has had such a kind of short but effective life. And I think when it started, it was just, for my frustrations anyway, for being in this industry for 15 years, constantly hitting my head against a brick wall by going, you're not going to be seen because of your arm. I should explain that I have my right arm finishes at the elbow. I was born without my right forearm. And I just got more and more frustrated. And the places where I thought I wouldn't find any kind of difficulties was Shakespeare, because there's no kind of limits on what you can do, especially, you know, now. And I got told time and time again that there are no parts. And I was like, but there must be. There must be. And I think it really does make a difference. Standing on that stage as a disabled actor makes people see that change is possible, and also that people can be represented on stage if you look like me, or if you look different. And I think that's really, really powerful.
And I guess Shakespeare seldom has any character say, look at both my arms simultaneously.
Nobody says that.
No one says that.
No one in life says that. So why should it matter? And I think that's become more and more part of the industry, is like it shouldn't matter, and it doesn't matter. you should be up there for merit alone.
Yeah.
And also, why not represent the society that we live in? I mean, he did. Yep. You know, when you look at how it's structured, the Globe, and you know, the Groundlings and all of that, it's all speaking to everybody. So why can't we have more people on stage that look different?
And you think the whole industry, you think the whole theatre industry is changing?
Yeah, I think it is. I think I've seen massive changes in the 5 years that since we've been around Act for Change, and also just in the conversations that I've had. I think people are much more open to having those conversations and feeling uncomfortable and pushing themselves to change the way in which things are cast, but not only casting, but backstage. How do we improve training for a lighting designer who's in a wheelchair? How do we get access to, you know, if we're especially in the Globe, how do we make that work? Mm-hmm. How do we make that work at places like the National? And I've seen more, as I walk around and see more shows and also see more backstage places when you're working with people, that there is a difference, that there are people who look a bit more like me and less the same. And I think it is changing. I mean, we've got loads to do, but there are steps forward. We just need to make some jumps, maybe.
Yeah, and there's a line which a colleague of mine pointed out from All's Well That Ends Well, which talks about unquestioned welcome. And he said, that's what we should be, that's how it should be. And I was like, yes, it's, we're not questioning whether or not you belong here, you do belong here, because you tap into the human condition, that very thing Shakespeare's
writing about.
That's
a beautiful phrase. I think for so long, deaf and disabled people and actors have felt unwelcome. And that's a really good way in which to look at it. Just speaking to people who've been turned away from theatres or not go to the theatre because it's not for them, because they're not represented or things aren't accessible.
So I have a concern that disabled actors sometimes have to be the pioneers for equality. So they've got two jobs
it's
on any...
tiring.
Yeah.
It is tiring. I definitely feel that. I think there's a huge responsibility because there are, as much as it's changed, there are still only a handful of us that you see the same people working. And what my concern is that also, how do we find more disabled and deaf and disabled actors? How do we find those people? How do you make the training accessible? And I think it's such a long process. And there's two jobs going on. So in rehearsals, you're always being the one that has to have the other perspective. So I feel like it is still it comes with a huge responsibility.
I remember us both being in a very different location at a very different meeting where someone was talking about disabled erasure and saying, but isn't it nice when disabled people can just say, don't even think about my disability?
Yes.
And I remember us both reacting quite viscerally.
Quite strongly, yeah. I think it's a dangerous place to be, because actually we're not in a society which is accepting yet. And also the way in which you describe yourself is actually incredibly empowering, and if that's taken away from you, then we've lost something quite important to say, you know, I am different and this is why I'm different and this is why you need to think about these things from my point of view, because I'm representative of this amount of people. And I think that's really important to keep saying it with pride.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's, you know, there's an importance in acting as well about knowing who you are and your identity, making sure that's firm before you go and embody other identities.
Yeah, but I think the brilliant thing about acting is that it is you. You are the, you know, you are the material. It's just finding those parts in a character that you identify with and heightening them. And I just remember someone at drama school saying to me that you'll never be as interesting pretending to be someone else than you already are. You're already vastly complex and endlessly interesting and fascinating. So don't try to pretend to be someone else. You are. And I think that really helped me in terms of, I could then incorporate all of my own feelings about my disability and kind of go, well, actually, there is so many rough bits to myself that if I was pretending to be someone else, I would have to try and mask the right side of me, because it's got some quite ugly feelings towards the world and myself and my relationship to my body, and actually kind of having all of that at your fingertips does enrich the way in which you present a character, because there's so much more humanity to it rather than, you know, something quite clean. And that's what I think is more interesting, when you see an actor being themselves as well as being someone else, there's something quite embodied, and that's quite exciting, because yeah. We spend so much of our time reducing ourselves in society by, you know, manners or your sexuality or your gender. You know, you're so many things you're apologising for, I think, especially in our culture. And actually to kind of have a place where you can go, no, this is me, it's quite a privilege. And I think it's quite empowering for other people. It has been for me. It's such a real privilege in life to allow yourself to be seen and to be seen by other people, because it validates you as a person. And I think that's something that I still feel needs to be really pushed, is that people need to see themselves, otherwise they feel invisible. And that's very painful, because you then go through your life feeling like you're not worth it. And to kind of see that reaction, literally by putting somebody on a stage in a wheelchair, or who's deaf, or who has one arm, is so empowering for people to believe that they can then do what they want to do. It's very simple in those terms. You know, it's a very simple act to do, to make people feel that they have a voice. So yeah.
So what would you, if you could change the theatre industry? So let's start with realistic steps and then
realistic.
Go into... Yeah, well, and then we can go into your other steps. But if you had the opportunity, I mean, would you start with training and drama schools?
I would really be interested in to see how do you make that building accessible to people, and then how do you change the training or change an acting class when you have people with different needs? You know, those are the things that I think we need to look at, because then I think more people would apply if they could see that the training was accessible. So training, I think, would be a very big thing for me, because a lot of disabled actors that I know haven't been formally trained in places that are recognised institutions, you know, and I think that's very important for your self-confidence and self-belief.
I think it's almost too simple sometimes for people to say disability as a term which covers something,
yeah.
And in their imaginations, you know, their paltry imaginations, but in their imaginations it's a wheelchair user. That is the default setting for the disabled body. You know, from that leaping to a really nuanced discussion about what is disability in an environment which is built by a scene designer, set designer, and is completely manipulated to ensure that you don't face any physical barriers.
So
where is what form of disability are we representing there? And that whole spectrum of dialogue can so easily be reduced.
You can be much more, I think it's much more creative than people think it is, like access in particular. You know, how do you incorporate audio description into a show? I remember with Reasons to be Cheerful, it was all set in a pub, and Pickles was on the phone the entire time, and it was like he was acting, that he was making phone calls, but he was audio describing the entire show. And I think if you haven't been open to the ways in which access in particular can be creative, then it does become very like, oh, we've got to make this work for these people on these dates, so let's just do this. And actually, from the very beginning of a show, you can incorporate things that are actually quite magical and creative. And what we all want to do is to make theatre that feels seamless, rather than, you know, there's something we've done.
Yeah.
We've ticked a massive box there, congratulations.
And there's a gift in there as well, I think, to, you know, younger people, younger disabled people who want to become actors or directors or whatever, to say, actually, your disability is a channel into a huge creative well from which the entire theatre industry could benefit.
Yeah, it taps into a whole perspective that other people haven't experienced. And to put that on a stage or on a TV show or in a film is such a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's that perspective that needs to change, because I think the barriers so far have been fear and resistance, but actually there are so many more offers on the table when you bring in, when you have in your production team, in your creative team, directing team, acting team, when you have people of difference, they are able to put so many more things on the table that they give you another way of looking at something. In the 15 years I've been doing it, I've seen really hopeful changes. Hope changes that make you cry. Hope that you think, God, this is actually possible, and people are doing it, and it doesn't seem to be a drama. It's just happening, and I think that's the most encouraging thing when you see something like that change.
Next up, Dougie Walker. Dougie is a comedian, actor and writer who recently joined us for a research and development day, looking at the relationship between visual impairment and comedy in Shakespeare. It centred partly around the character of old Gobbo in The Merchant of Venice, who is explicitly stated as being visually impaired, a rarity in Shakespeare. Here's Dougie.
Hello, my name's Douglas Walker and I am an actor and a comedian and an improviser.
So in your acting...
Yes.
I guess an important question for us is your relationship as an actor or a performer or a writer to Shakespeare.
Well, until very recently, my relationship was really just an audience member. And it was only a couple of months ago that I had performed my first ever bit of Shakespeare for a course I did called Pathways, which was run by Extant. And it was a group of eight of us, all visually impaired performers. And we did sort of a series of workshops over a period of about 6 months. How would I describe it? A survey of opportunities or options for actors. So we visited a few different sort of drama schools. We tried a few different techniques that we looked at, a few different sort of styles of theatre. We did some physical theatre, we did some Shakespeare. And this sort of culminated in this showcase where I ended up doing that. I mean, I would never have chosen at the beginning of that course to do a Shakespeare monologue. In fact, even when we were discussing what pieces we should do for the showcase, it was suggested that I do this piece of Shakespeare, and I was like, I don't know. I don't know if that's what I should do. Yeah.
Because I think what's interesting as well is that Accent, as a theatre company, have taken on responsibility to open those opportunities up.
Yeah.
To visually impaired people, visually impaired people who might not be able to get classic training or whom drama schools aren't accessible.
Yeah, and it was great in that kind of way. Like, there's so many different aspects of being an actor or performer of any kind, only one of which is the performing. There's a whole other kind of side of it, kind of business of it, of, you know, how do you go about looking for work? How do you go about networking? How do you, I mean, for me, yeah, being visually impaired, the networking, that's the biggie. That's like, it's not just that networking is not a accessible activity for visually impaired people, it's that I can't see how you would make it one. You know, it's really, so much is based on knowing who you're talking to and knowing who you've met before and seeing who's in a room and all these kinds of things. And so it was really interesting to kind of bring together this group of performers and talking to some professionals who've been in the industry for a long time and seeing how they go about it and thinking about, right, how are we going to tackle this aspect of the industry? It sort of exists in between professional and personal, and there are not clear working practices and all these kinds of things, you know. So it's really interesting area to try and consider in terms of accessibility.
Yeah. Just one thing, an actor starting their career having the confidence to approach that director they met once in a bar. But it's another thing if you aren't even aware that director is in the bar.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because it's all stuff that is, you know, the same in your normal life as a visually impaired person. So I very rarely greet anyone with a great deal of enthusiasm in a situation where I'm not expecting to see them. If someone says, oh, hey, Dougie, I generally am not that effusive because I don't know who it is. So it's hard to pitch exactly how, you know, is it someone you know from work? Is it, you know, a very close friend?
An ex.
Is it an ex? Absolutely. And so that kind of caution, you know, years of that, it changes your personality, you know, so that becomes actually not just a technique, a mechanism, that starts being what you're like as a person. And so that, I think, transfers through into the kind of networking thing, of the kind of stereotypical lovey, darling, air kisses, excitement to see one another. It's very difficult to sort of pull out any sort of version of that when you're used to keeping your cards very close to your chest of whether you know who it is you're talking to or not.
What's your relationship to the Globe?
What's my relationship to the Globe? So, a few months ago, I was very kindly invited along to what's a research and development sort of workshop. What we were looking at was the comedy surrounding visually impaired characters in Shakespeare scenes, mainly Merchant of Venice. It was really fascinating. There was a really great mix of visually impaired and fully sighted performers, and also a mix of actors and comedians.
Because it remains a really nuanced conversation, especially that old Corvo scene, where it's a character who is rarely for Shakespeare written with a characteristic.
Right.
You create so many characters who you all feel we really, really know, but who are actually very easily manipulated by an actual director's ideas. Mm. Whereas visually impaired, like old Cobbo is visually impaired.
Yeah.
I to this day find it a very, very uncomfortable scene, so it was surprising when, more from the comedian side, and correct me if I'm forgetting this incorrectly, but the comedians say, actually, if you look at it, old Cobbo sort of ends up on top of the comedy structure here.
Yeah. There are certain things that work comedically, which you might nevertheless say, yeah, that functions as a joke, you know, and it maybe functions very well as a joke, because the things that you need to make a joke work, in a way, are quite straightforward. You essentially want to create a misunderstanding and then, or create an ambiguity and then resolve it in the way that the listener wasn't expecting. And so you can have things that work, that function really well comedically, that nevertheless you go, but you know, there's some other reason that we don't want to use this. Not that it doesn't work as a piece of comedy, but that, you know, it's distasteful to us for any number of variety of other reasons. The question of that old Gobbo scene, I think, it would be very easy to kind of look at it and say, this is sort of making fun of someone because they're blind. And if it is just that, then yeah, absolutely, it's an unpleasant scene. And even if the comedy works, which is a separate question, you might say, we're not interested. But there's another way of looking at it, which is Lancelot has a certain hubris that he thinks he's playing a funny joke, and then it comes round to bite him. And there's a sense in which that could be a very empowering piece of comedy, where this blind character, you can sort of see the way someone is making fun of him. And then, arguably unwittingly, he ends up getting his own back. And maybe doesn't realise he's getting his own back. And maybe that's funnier. Mm. I mean, there's a sense in which people do make fun of disabled people. To depict that, you know, that's certainly not, on the face of it, a bad thing. You know, you definitely want to depict that. And to have a scene where that goes wrong for the person making fun of the disabled person, well, that could be quite a cathartic piece of comedy. You'd have to play it exactly right.
Reflect that notion back to the audience.
Yeah. I'm sure there'd be far more ways you could play it wrong, and maybe one or two that you could play it right. But I do think it would be possible. When these two characters interact in this way, you know, it would be very possible to read that scene in a vacuum and take one impression of it, but we have to be reading it through a comedy lens. So this is meant to be, you know, this is meant to fulfil a certain function. So how is it what do I have to do to my understanding of it to see it in that way? And is it possible? You know, it could be that, you know, the scenes are just so out of context with how society currently is that you can't do that work to see it as comedy anymore. But I think a lot of the time, you know, there is a way of seeing it as comedy, and if I think as a comedian, I'm quite keen to, you know, if you can make it funny, if you can take something that could be upsetting, but go, no, look, it's funny, it's okay, it's fulfilling a worthwhile function, then that I think is valuable and exciting, and that's the kind of comedy I want to see. I wouldn't say this is an opinion, this is a line of inquiry. Do you think that people approach things like Shakespeare differently to something modern? Where if you look at things like something like Catastrophe, that I really enjoyed recently, and the things that they're talking about are awful. There's bereavement, there's terminal illness, there's, you know, infidelity, there's alcoholism, there's serious things that are serious in people's lives. But of course that's the fodder that we choose for comedy, because those are the things that we're trying to deal with and understand. And you could easily, as a person affected by any of those issues, look at them and go, well, that thing isn't funny. And you sort of say, well, no, the comedy isn't there to say that alcoholism is funny. It's comedy is a way of approaching that. And do you think that people have lost that sense with Shakespeare if they kind of look at these things and say, well, look, these are bad things, so can we find them funny in Shakespeare?
That is a really interesting line of inquiry. I guess, you know, the function of comedy is a very, very big question. In terms of how people approach Shakespeare, I think the big difference is from modern writing has so much literalism in it.
Right.
Often. Not always, often. And a case in point would actually be visually impaired or disabled people or deaf people taking on roles in Shakespeare, whereby, with the exception of Old Gobbo, that there isn't really that signal for many other characters.
Yeah. It's interesting to look at any drama, actually, because you say, you know, apart from Old Gobbo in Shakespeare, there's you know, there aren't
very
characters,
very
few characters that you would say, well, that character is visually impaired. That's not different to modern work. You know, there are very few characters that are written as visually impaired unless you're writing a play about visual impairment, unless you're writing a script about visual impairment. It'd be interesting to look at how many stories, how many of the characters that we watch every day, for how many of them is it necessary that they're not visually impaired or you know, any other characteristic you want to choose? Probably surprisingly, a surprising amount of them could be visually impaired and it just doesn't happen to affect the story. If you look at Friends, any of the six friends could have been visually impaired or could have been, and very few of the episodes would have to change, because when visually impaired people live their life is not about being visually impaired, you know. So that's an interesting question with a lot of these things is, you know, if you take a soliloquy and, or you take a part, am I going to be informed by the fact that I'm visually impaired? And it's interesting to know what that would mean to have the part informed by that. If you're not going to change what the character says or does, you know, how they act.
No, I completely agree. It doesn't. No,
yeah.
It shouldn't be a primary motivation of the character. It's. There is a. I think there is a place in the modern canon for topic theatre, which is addressing something around itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
But then, where's the rest of the space for people who just happen to be visually impaired?
It'd be really interesting. I don't know. I don't know what I think about it. To have a character in a play or in a show, in the sitcom or something, who was visually impaired but it was never really talked about. I sort of think it would be brilliant, but it would also, I don't think people would be able to cope with it. You would let them know by, there'd be a few points, there'd be a point in, you know, the play, in the episode or something, where they have to ask someone to read a sign for them, or, and then it wouldn't get mentioned again. And the audience, I don't think, could handle it. It wouldn't occur to people that you would just put a character like that in a play because there are people like that in the world, but this play isn't about that. Yeah, I could go about my daily life. Most of the time, I could go about my daily life and most people don't know I'm visually impaired. And yet, things happen to me that are worthy of high drama. So, you know, I could be a character in a play who is visually impaired, and yet it doesn't really come up.
And you did get a chance to perform on the Globe stage.
Yes.
So did the space unlock anything for you?
We were doing a workshop. You know, pick someone in the audience and talk to them. What's interesting about that, as a visually impaired performer, being on stage is one of the areas where you feel most equal. This environment doesn't require me to have a lot of visual information about what's in front of me, because I'm in command of the space around me and I know what I'm doing and saying. But that was all of a sudden the thing where I'm like, oh yeah, this is something that I can't quite do, is make eye contact with someone in the audience. So that presented difficulty. That was an interesting thing that was like, that feels right for how this should work. And yet, unfortunately, that feels like an area in which I can't quite do the same thing as a sighted performer. You know, and being visually impaired, you spend a lot of your time pretending to make eye contact. I'm sure you could learn the skills to do the same thing of manufacturing that, those tiny movements of the face that make it obvious that you've connected with someone, and you could sort of make that up, and that would be a different element to your performance that you would have to learn. But that was something that I was sort of struck by.
So do you feel, just, is there pressure to act in a way which is, you know, the supposed normative?
It's an interesting question, and I think it kind of maybe goes back to what we were saying before about whether being visually impaired informs your character, mm-hmm. and whether any part of what you're doing is about visual impairment. There are times when that might not be what you're trying to convey, and so it may be a distraction to have that too prominently within the way you present something. I mean, the truth is, just in your normal life, as a visually impaired person, you're compromising a certain amount. People show me things on their phones. People who know I'm visually impaired, but they show me something on their phone, and I decide whether to go through the process of telling them I can't see it, or just pretend that I have seen it. And, you know, if it's a picture of their cat or their holiday or their kid, sometimes the easiest thing to do is just go, oh, yeah, oh, no, you know. Yeah. And so you spend a lot of your life making little compromises and deciding, shall I, you know, you go into a sandwich shop and you order something you know they definitely have, rather than getting them to read you out the whole menu. And that's a choice that you make, mm-hmm. on each individual occasion. I think there's no reason that wouldn't extend into your work, mm-hmm. where there's a choice you make where you go, okay, I'm going to do some pretending here because actually I'm more interested in getting across something else. You know, I'm more interested in other aspects of this scene than what it's like to be a visually impaired actor and how the audience are going to react to it.
Next, Jessie Parrott. Jessie is a writer, actor, and PhD student who specialises in disability in the arts industry and disability in Shakespeare. David chatted to her about how she approached the subject, given modern frames and definitions of disability are so vastly different to those in Shakespeare's day, and how her relationship with Shakespeare has affected her life both on and off stage.
I'm Jessie Parrott, and for anyone for whom it would be useful for, because this is a podcast, I am a white woman in her mid-20s and I'm a wheelchair user. And the reason I'm here is that I'm an actress and a PhD student working on disability as an employment issue in the arts, but also my undergrad thesis was on disability in Shakespeare, so.
Thank you for coming. Shall we jump straight in and talk about disability in Shakespeare? And I want to talk a little bit, I want you to talk more specifically about models of disability and what frameworks you used to discuss what disability is in Shakespeare.
Okay, so I think a good place to start is that the two most known models of disability are the medical and social models of disability which theoretically function in opposition, in that the medical model is one that situates disability within the body or mind of a particular individual that then relates to the difference that they experience, and the onus is then on the individual to adapt accordingly to interact with society, whereas the social model suggests that people are disabled by society rather than by their bodies or their minds, and so it's society and attitudes and barriers that need to change. They were both very particularly situated in the civil rights movement of the 1970s and early 80s in the UK. So that doesn't always necessarily work too well when you're working with a playwright who was writing four centuries ago. So when working with Shakespeare, and indeed any pre-20th century playwright, it's kind of useful to think outside of those models. There are other models that are more useful. Tom Shakespeare set up the embodied ontological perspective. It's kind of combining the lived experience of having a body or mind that works in a different way with the attitudinal and social barriers that people experience. In terms of this conversation, it's also probably useful to mention the work of Chris Mountsey, who is an 18th centuryist who is visually impaired, and he works on the concept of variability, which is the idea that we are all the same, only different. And so my experience of disability on a social level will be the same as his in terms of exclusion, but it will also be different because the nature of our individual impairment is different. And that's useful because it encompasses the fact that there wasn't a political identity around disability prior to the civil rights movement. Yeah.
There's so much to unpack in just even what a frame of reference to disability is when we think about Shakespeare or performance, or for us, about our spaces.
It's the Globe and the Yard space is one of the only spaces where I can pretty much have the same experience theatrically as any other member of the audience, because having the ramp and then being raised up then means that I'm not disadvantaged by people suddenly standing up and being in front of me, but also it means that I'm right in the thick of the interaction with the stage, because in some venues we are very specifically placed as wheelchair users. So yeah, I do wonder if it's something about the particular nature of Shakespeare that then makes it more conducive to accessibility.
I think that's a really interesting question, and I think it's certainly true in terms of the plays themselves, and again the mythology of the normative body, this idea, you know, that there's no pressure from Shakespeare in physical or neurological casting.
No.
Absolutely not. Because he's not a literal writer. You know, he's working in an imaginative mode of language, and he's asking audiences to do more work.
And there are very few stage directions as well, so much of the work that we have to do is imagining on top of what he's written in terms of the dialogue. So that I think that gives a lot of scope for different ways of staging and different ways of moving. Yeah, I remember having conversations about my particular soapbox, which is Katerina in Taming of the Shrew, and because I really read her as having a limp, which is something that's mentioned in the script. And then to me that makes for a really interesting perspective on her relationship to the gender roles at the time. But I mentioned this to somebody once and they said, no, but her only disability is her gender. So that's not a valid reading at all. But I said, look, it's literally in the script. And they kind of said, no, but that's, you can't make a reading based on a single line in the text. And to me, that's what directors do all the time.
But also there's a point of erasure in there, isn't there, where you have been told this limp is not, it isn't neither relevant nor character defining nor...
Which really fascinated me, because actually Petruchio literally says to Kate, why doth the world report that Kate doth limp? That's something interesting, I think, about people's general engagement with disability, that they tend to feel that people's impairments at this point, if you have a visibly disabled actor on stage, then it almost is that it has to be making a point about their presence there, rather than it just being something that's just there, like it is in society. Disabled people are just there. People with impairments, especially visible physical impairments, tend to perform off stage as well as on stage. And so then maybe when we take ownership of that performance, people find it quite difficult to comprehend, to tease out. So then I find that interesting, because actually if we are performing, then that makes us inherently set up well to then take up the stage, but we don't seem to be allowed to. And it's interesting, because I know that actually if we widen the definition of access a little, when you think about it from an educational level, a lot of people might consider that Shakespeare isn't that accessible to them, perhaps because of the way it's taught. But actually, for me, it was certainly Shakespeare that in some ways helped me to better articulate my disabled identity in a way that other playwrights, I've actively had to search to find myself in the so-called modern dramatic canon, whereas, I mean, we've talked about Kate, but also I remember being on the Shakespeare Summer School at RADA, and one of the tutors brought me Richard III, and I read the play, and especially the opening monologue, and I had a meltdown on the floor of one of the rehearsal rooms, because Shakespeare, through him, seemed to have this fundamental understanding of what it was like to be disabled in society. I didn't read it like I've become the way I am because of my body, but it was, I've become the way I am because of my response to other people's responses to me. And in saying that, obviously I'm not condoning any of the actions that he then takes from that basis, but I did fundamentally understand, because I live with a scoliosis and dogs bark at my chair on a regular basis. So that was a very, very literal experience for me. And to have somebody from 400 years ago articulate that, and to do so succinctly, was overwhelming. It showed me that I didn't just have to find stories to tell, they were already there. And that's really huge, knowing that you're not the first and that you don't necessarily have to be a trailblazer when it comes to either performance or activism or anything. It's just really nice to know that people have gone before.
No, really interesting points, I think. There's a certain amount of literalism in modern writing, which actually presents a barrier.
Absolutely, and I think it's important that we push for that and new writing to be authentic and to reflect that experience. But actually, I don't necessarily always want to be playing my life. At the same time, there are other aspects of the world that I want to portray and have the opportunity just to play Viola, just to play Juliet, just to play whoever, and to show that perhaps my presence as a wheelchair user could be an interesting comment on that particular role, but actually it doesn't necessarily have to be. I do want people to understand a bit more, and the less education that I have to do, the better. Not that I'm saying I don't want to educate. I'll happily have conversations with people, because I do think that it has to start somewhere, and sometimes if I don't, then nobody will, and I'd rather them understand things than carry on in their ignorance. But educating can get exhausting, so I think the more that we can have different possibilities of having that education, which I think theatre is one of those ways, the better, really.
Oh, I totally agree, and I think, you know, what better tool is there for exercising our imaginative and empathetic faculties than theatre?
Absolutely. One of the things that I found useful recently is in the world of children's literature rather than theatre, but there's the concept of mirrors and windows around books, and so certain books give people mirrors to reflect back, and so that's kind of the dilemma that we are wanting, because we want more representation that reflects, but also then there's a responsibility for plays potentially to be windows that then open up people to other perspectives that do not mirror their own, so that they can have more understanding of that.
I guess so, but if you extend that metaphor, don't you also find that with any window there's an amount of reflection?
Yes, and I think obviously, of course, we need to address the fact it's a very sight-centric metaphor.
Yeah.
But isn't that an interesting point about how then if we represent wider society, people will understand that actually that experience is not so far from our own?
That's it from Such Stuff for this week, but the work around disability and performance on and off our stages continues. You can find out more about the projects mentioned and others on our website. The Access Scheme allows us to better understand the requirements of deaf and disabled patrons and ensures they receive adjusted ticket prices. To find out more, either call us on 0207 902 1409 or email access@shakespearesglobe.com. You've been listening to Such Stuff with me, Imogen Greenberg, and David Bellwood. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe and what's on, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be back with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe, so subscribe wherever you got this podcast from.